It's like whenever you turn on your TV, check your social media, check your phone, the rise in mass shootings consumes the headlines. It's something that's become an unavoidable reality for us here in the United States. But what does the oversaturation of violence in the media, especially real-life violence, do to our psyches? There are so many areas of life that have been impacted by the fear of mass shootings, raising the question, what's happening to our minds as we continue to process this incredible amount of shootings that happen in this country? Joining me in studio right now, it's called Shiftia Graham, of course, and on the phone, Dr. Pontus Leander. He is the director of the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies here at Wayne State University. Welcome to Culture Shift, Dr. Leander.
Thank you.
All right, so first off, tell us about your work at the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies here at Wayne State. There is some incredible work happening there, especially under the Center for Psychological Gun Research. We're going to talk about some of that research today. So give us an overview of the work you've been doing there.
So I recently moved to Wayne State about a year ago because of interest in gun violence, interest in these broad cultural changes that are happening in the U.S. and how some of these cultural changes are including a culture of violence and a culture of gun violence in particular. And what you talked about before, that this notion that we are constantly being confronted with extreme acts of violence, is that influencing us? Not only in terms of fear, but are we in some ways, not only is it changing us or influencing us to change our behavior, but does it affect us in ways that we may not expect or even want, such as the normalization of violence, the acceptance of violence, or even creating ideas about how to take action oneself?
When you say this culture of violence, what exactly is under that umbrella for you? Are we talking about violence in film and television? Are we talking about literally the violence we see every single day? Are we talking about even our military presence in the world here from the U.S.? There's a lot of violence that we have to deal with because of that. So what exactly falls under that category?
So one of the goals of the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies is to ask the big question, which means that we have to look holistically at all the kinds of influences that exist in a given country or a given media environment and start thinking about what kinds of messages are being signaled collectively. Even if no single source is communicating an idea, what happens when there's a collection of sources and people, especially young people who are striving for achievement, who want to be respected, who want to be important, who want to be seen as competent and effective or even powerful in the world? How do the types of information, including multiple sources of information about violence, even warnings about it happening or just attempts to inform people that it's happening, how does that change their way of thinking about their own behavior, right? And so it could be anything. But in my research, and I'm just one researcher of many, there is this question about, well, what about, well, there is gun violence, but then what about these high-profile mass shooting events? And keeping in mind that the kinds of mass shootings that reach national news are only a fragment of the mass shootings that happen. Those are the big ones. Those are the ones where the there's a lot of victims. Those are the ones that make significant headlines. But many mass shootings, including one that happened here in Michigan, they don't reach that level. So we have to keep in mind that we're only getting a glimpse of the amount of gun violence that's actually occurring.
I'm kind of curious, how far back does your work look? Because, you know, we in the last two decades, we've seen an incredible increase in the amount of mass gun violence, mass shootings here in the country. But they really go back to the late 1950s, early 1960s, with what happened at University of Texas way back when. Have you looked that far back? And have you the cycle of violence that you're talking about, do you feel like it began at a certain point in our history?
Oh, yeah, I'm not ready to answer that one because one of the challenges one has as a psychologist is that we look at life while it's still alive. So we can only study people and their thoughts in the moment. So I started this research in 2016 in the immediate aftermath of the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting. And what we did there was right as that shooting happened, we were just by circumstance launching a large survey to study hundreds of U.S. gun owners, their beliefs about guns, the appropriateness of using them, various fears and concerns and frustrations going on in life. And suddenly that shooting happened. And what that alerted us to was that people have a lot of thoughts in this. And mass shootings are a context where we might be able to learn a lot about not only violence and fear, but also about what people want for themselves or how people might try to navigate their environment or even kind of the bigger belief systems people try to, or not try to, but that they develop in this kind of context.
And your research that you were doing with in 2016 with gun ownership, what were some of the results that you were seeing and what was it telling you about society?
So I think the most important finding from our earlier research, which spanned the Orlando shooting to the Las Vegas Strip shooting that happened a year later, the Texas shooting at Sutherland Springs, the church shooting, and many that followed. There's from those studies, what we see is that there's really two kinds of, I don't want to say fears, but senses of threat that people have. There's a very concrete and specific fear of crime or concerns about crime, you know, being a victim of violence or being mugged or having one's home invaded. And that itself, if we think about that as like a variable that you can, you know, analyze statistically and see if that correlates with other outcomes, a concrete or a really specific concern about violent crime is only part of the story. There's an entire separate concern, which is really more of a belief system, that the world is a dangerous place and that there's bad people out there. And this is what we call a more global or abstract sense of threat. And that is, in our data, it's a totally separate variable that people might develop maybe intuitively or over time, we don't know. But the idea is that that concrete fear of crime is only part of what is leading people to engage in different kinds of behaviors. There's also this bigger concern, this more abstract concern about how the world works. And we don't know whether that leads to bigger plans or more extreme ideas. But what we do know is that that more abstract concern is the larger predictor of the kinds of outcomes that we might be most concerned about if we're worried about whether things like mass shootings or culture of violence are influencing us in ways that we may not realize or expect in terms of our tolerance for violence or even our preparedness for violence.
So Dr. Leander, again, we're talking to Dr. Pontus Leander of the Wayne State Center for Peace and Conflict Studies about the psychology of mass shootings, how they happen and how they perpetuate, especially here in the United, well, specifically here in the U.S., we are the ones in the world with the major problem of this. So, Dr. Leander, something you said that I'm curious about. So, you studied mass shooters themselves and their psychology, and you've studied people affected by this kind of violence, and all of us who view this kind of violence and get a sense of it from what we see in the media. So what would you say is a bigger problem? Is the media coverage of mass shootings and the intensity of that violence, is that sparking more mass shooters? Or are you more concerned about the effects that seeing this violence and it happening in our communities having upon all of us who maybe are not gun owners or would not be prone to being a mass shooter?
So my main concern is this idea of copycat behavior. Before I got involved in gun research or even research on violence and aggression, basic unconscious processes where we mimic and copy the people around us. This is something we all do as kids, right? We learn from seeing those around us, and we learn how to meet our needs and pursue our goals through basically imitation, if not exact imitation, then kind of some variant of that imitation. So that's what we just call social learning, right? And that's what I'm concerned about now. And much of my research is focused on that question of, you know, does even this interview increase the perceived power and importance of mass shootings so that there's, you know, maybe just one listener out there who hears, well, okay, mass shootings are way to be important or way to be powerful. Got it. You know, I would never do that myself, but maybe, you know, that might be something that gets learned from all this kind of coverage. And so that's one key concern. The other concern is that at a more direct level, as we've seen with hate crimes and as we've seen with these what appear to be white supremacist mass shootings that target historically victimized communities here in the U.S., but also internationally, that there is a communication going on. People might use a mass shooting to, you know, some have argued that they try to use it to start a race war or to continue one, right? So there's people have these ideas or narratives in their mind. But what I'm mainly concerned about is what is it that makes these actions so, I don't want to say attractive, but so motivating or powerful in some people's minds? And just as an example, the tragedy that happened at Oxford High School, which we conducted a survey in response to that among hundreds of gun owners outside of Michigan. But what we were seeing in Michigan was that there was this extraordinary, I don't know if it was unprecedented, but it was certainly unusual, surge in copycat threats from other students all around the U.S. Even the hometown I grew up in Tennessee, had a copycat threat. And so that kind of copycat threat or copycat violence, that's basic imitation. Even if the exact behaviors they do is different, it suggests that they've picked up on something about a shooting or about the way the shootings are presented or maybe even about the way the gunmen now become known. And that's really the focus of my work.
So two things that bring that brought up for me as a journalist and as a person who is very interested in communication and information and the flow of it, we have to talk about these things that are happening, right? Like if we do not cover them and they're not talked about in the media, not only is it a disservice to the public, but it is also people would not see it as the problem that it is, and thus creating, you know, action to limit the amount of violence that we're seeing, the amount of mass shootings. So that I'd like you to address. And the other one is that, you know, do you, in this research that you're doing, are you finding that violence or the I guess what I'm trying to say here, you're talking about copycat threats after the Oxford High School shooting. Now, a copycat threat is just a threat, but to follow through on that takes an entire, to me, another motivation. Do you see those as different?
Mm-hmm. I do. So let me start with the first one. So this is an ideological answer as much as anything. I mean, we someone like me would argue that we have a right to be aware. We have a right to be educated. The challenge is not the information itself. It's the rewards and the motivating potential of that information. And that's why this question about whether we are living in a culture that either implicitly or unconsciously or subtly conveys social importance and significance and respect to violence in a way that we, and that's a big question, and in a way that we should think about and address and confront more directly and start asking whether that's a culture we want our kids growing up in, a culture that we want to perpetuate. And is that, or and if it is, then what is it that we're gaining from that culture that we need to hold on to? So that's kind of the big question there. So, you know, we are empowered by knowledge, but at the same time, in this historical context, in this moment, you know, we're in American history with the technology and the tools and what's going on and the opportunity structures that exist, for some reason, some people, especially in the United States, are looking to mass shootings as it's something that they need to do, and they are very motivated to do it, and that's what we have to target. So the next question, I might have already answered that. I think, at least from my current perspective, is this question about, is there something specially motivating about that knowledge? And I don't think that's something that, I mean, okay, there's a way that media can present information, sure, that's outside my scope. I think the question is oftentimes if we're talking psychologically and only psychologically for just a moment, do we have enough scientific knowledge to know what's going on in people's minds, to even know what human beings are motivated to do? You know, we know so little about human motivation. After we get past those basic physiological needs, we know we have certain kinds of social needs, but we're still, you know, this field is, what, 100 years old? I mean, we've still got so much work to do to catch up on that.
And, you know, you talked about that a little bit, about the motivation, and talk about unconscious motivations here and how that may lead to some of the copycat issue or copycat crimes that we're seeing happening across the country. What role does unconscious motivation play in that?
Yeah, so this is what brought me into psychology. I was fascinated by this idea that we as human beings can have motivations that we are either not consciously aware of, or maybe we were at some point, but they've become so automatic or ingrained that we just do them automatically and don't, or habitually, and don't even think about it anymore. But it sort of pervades our actions. And you know, sometimes it takes another person to point it out to us that we have a certain tendency or a habit or a character flaw or whatever it is. And maybe that's a motive that we might have. So whether it's currently unconscious or previously unconscious, or it's always been, maybe there are evolutionary motives that have no reason to enter conscious awareness. I don't know. The challenge we're dealing with now is that research is ongoing on these kinds of questions, even the question of whether unconscious motives really exist. Is it really possible to be motivated for something that never enters conscious awareness, really? Mm-hmm. And so, but those are fundamental questions that are fundamentally psychological questions, that, and trying to extend that all the way to explain what's going on with a mass shooting and the way we might be influenced, I think a starting point just to ask these kinds of questions are, well, sometimes we might not notice that in a certain context or a certain situation that we are gradually, over maybe a period of weeks or months or years, getting used to the idea of a behavior that was previously not only not normative, but appalling. And then after people engage in that behavior for a while, it's okay, it's still appalling, but our emotional reaction is weaker, right? And over time, our emotional reactions kind of rehabituate to that, it normalizes. And what that might suggest is that certain ideas or certain events or certain actions, including you know, what we're being exposed to, we become more efficient at dealing with it. And that might mean that some of this, even some of our initial reactions or responses, are themselves becoming relatively unconscious. And so if we're thinking about motivations in response, so this sense of threat or fear that we talked about, so not only the threat of violent crime actually being, for example, in a mass shooting, but this broader belief about the world being a dangerous place, we develop these broader intuitions. And those intuitions, in turn, like a belief system, is going to change the way we make decisions about our everyday behaviors in ways that we might not realize came from these sources. And I think, and research on this is ongoing. And one of the, you know, compounding the tragedy is that given how much we have to work with, or really how little we have to work with, it's likely to be years, if not decades, before we're going to understand mass shootings in a way that, I would argue, is true understanding of why they're happening, why they've been ongoing. I mean, research on gun violence in general is behind by several decades. And so, and there's a lot of catching up to do, like I've said before.
Again, we're talking to Dr. Pontus Leander of the Wayne State Center for Peace and Conflict Studies here on Culture Shift here on Detroit's NPR station, WDET. We're going to wrap up with you in a few minutes, Dr. Leander, but, you know, as you were saying there, these unconscious motivations that we don't understand are present in all human beings, but it would seem to me, especially for those who are younger, which we often see now a part of these mass shootings, we're seeing young men who are still teenagers or still in their 20s doing these horrendous acts of violence. And I wonder, in that study, it must be very difficult because a lot of times the brain is not fully developed at that point. You don't know why you do a lot of what you do in general, but to do something so horrific, it seems even more difficult. So I'm kind of curious about that. And these 18-year-olds, especially, that have done some of the most recent mass shootings, these are people that have grown up in a world where this was the norm. You know, a lot of older listeners probably remember the days when we did not have a mass shooting seemingly every other week. But is there a difference between that and growing up in a world where this happens regularly?
I think that's one of the most important questions of the day, right? Is that, are we now creating an environment where a young person, especially someone who's maybe has ideas about what it means to be a man or what it means to be strong or what it means to be respected, and is where mass shootings are one of many options on how to get there. And over time, they might pursue realize that they're good or bad at academics, or realize that they have a talent or they don't have a talent, or they might reach a crisis moment where, you know, if we talk about, you know, the development of a teenager's mind, when they're in a state of crisis or emotional crisis or other things are going on in their life that things are out of control, is a mass shooting a so-called shortcut to feeling or experiencing something that a person that age, and maybe mostly young men, that they are highly motivated to experience? And this sort of alignment between this specific behavior, a mass shooting, with the needs and motives of a certain demographic of people in our country, in that broader context of what have they learned, what's normal, what gets attention out there in the world. I mean, that's a set of confluences that requires a tremendous amount of, to study that requires a tremendous amount of resources we don't have, and time, and another thing we don't have.
Dr. Leander, last question. What are the three biggest takeaways from your research that people need to know?
So there are basically three themes that I've looked at. One is this question about this tendency for when a mass shooting happens, who is most likely to have these ideas about using guns in their own lives? And from what we can currently say about the data, which may turn out to be wrong years from now, but what we're seeing now is that there is an element of frustration. So people who are frustrated within their own lives or with society, that's a component. Two, it tends to be people who already own guns, who have the means available. And what we see is that when a mass shooting is really looming large in a person's mind, even if they would never commit one themselves or even think about it, the fact that it's, if it's what we say salient, increases their own rationalization and justification to use guns across a variety of self-defense scenarios, including things like saving a vulnerable stranger in distress or deterring intimidation by troublemakers. So that's one. So there is this very low level, very generalized concern of mimicry among certain types of people, those of us in the normal population, so to speak. Two, another area that we haven't really talked about today is this notion of when mass shootings target historically victimized communities, there is this big questions about prejudice and hate crimes. And one thing we see in our data that we've been trying to understand is why do some people seem to downplay that a hate crime occurred in the first place? And from without getting into the specifics, what we've seen across multiple mass shooting events that have targeted minorities is that members of the broader public, gun owners or not, if they have their own grievances with society, if they have their own prejudices against that minority group, these are the folks that are most likely to say, no, that wasn't a hate crime, or at least disagree with the idea that it might have been motivated by prejudicial bias. So there's something going on there that has to do with what we might call intergroup conflict. Right, so the different racial and ethnic groups that exist in the U.S. And the third one, which has been studied across disciplines for several years, is mass shootings. One of the fears, so while many of us are afraid of being in a mass shooting, people who appreciate gun rights, when a mass shooting happens, they have a second fear that their freedoms are going to be threatened and taken away. And so what we might see is a surge in activity to protect gun freedoms, to engage in consumer behavior, to buy products that one might fear are going to be restricted soon. And so so that's an area that we're trying to understand. What are the motivations really behind, you know, because when a mass shooting happens, it's not like everyone runs out and buys a gun. It's who does it and why. And again, what we're seeing is that people who have these underlying frustrations with society or in their own lives also tend to be the ones who respond to this kind of threat to gun freedom with at least an intention to buy a gun. You know, we're still trying to gather enough resources to follow through on some of these studies. So those are the big three areas. So this question of copycat behavior, the question of indifference or to the victims or downplaying of hate crimes, and then the third one is this increase in consumer behavior, which increases the number of guns out there.
Thank you so much. Dr. Pontus Leander is the director of the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies here at Wayne State University. Really appreciate your time today and appreciate this conversation. And we are definitely going to have you back because there's a lot of interesting research that you guys are doing over there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.